And thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward, director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University, and I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm today. She'll be back on Monday. And we've got some news. The U.S. economy added jobs last month for the first time since May, but unemployment remains high. And yesterday's stocks reached their highest level since September 2008, following the Federal Reserve's move to inject $600 billion into the economy. President Obama said he'll be seeking immediate action on tax cuts set to expire at the end of the year. Well, joining me to talk about these and other national news stories of this very significant week, David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine, Lisa Lehrer, politics reporter, Bloomberg News, and Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent, Washington Examiner. Good to see you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And quite a day it's been so far. Let's start with the jobs report, because this is very significant. Economy added 151,000 jobs in October. That's a big change from 4 months of job losses. Other numbers have been revised so that the previous months don't look quite as bleak, but hardly a raging bull here that's going to put America back to work. Byron?
Well, the headline number is 9.6%, which is that the unemployment rate has stayed at 9.6% third month in a row. And I think that that is what people are going to take away from it. The subheadline is, yes, there jobs have been added, not enough to bring the unemployment rate down. But if you're looking for green shoots, that and perhaps what the Fed has just done possibly means good news on the horizon. But for everybody else, it's 9.6%.
There's another percent, Lisa, that actually matters as well. And that's 17%. And 17% is the percentage of underemployed, people who are working part-time, plus the unemployed who would like to have jobs. So a very, very long way to go, even though there may be, as Byron said, some green shoots here.
Right, that's exactly right. I think for most people, you know, most people who voted in the election, most voters out there in the country, they're not really seeing this as much improvement. They're looking at the 9.6, as you said. They're also looking at their home values. Maybe they're, I think 23% of people are underwater in their foreclosure. That's where a lot of people's money is, right, tied up. So they're not really feeling this in terms of their personal economic situation. And so we're going to see that reverberate through the politics. And certainly we're not going to see a softening of feeling, I think, towards President Obama because of these numbers.
David, how do you read the new numbers?
Well, you know, you have to create about 150,000 jobs a month just to keep even with population growth, let alone make up for the 8 million jobs that were lost because of the Bush-Cheney crash. So really to start feeling the impact on this, for people to see Obama making up the ground that was lost at the end of the Bush-Cheney years, you're going to have to basically double these numbers, maybe triple them. And it's going to take months, if not years. I mean, economists talk about a five-year trend on the path we're on now to get back to recovering some of this, making up for some of that job loss. And that's going to take dramatic action. The stimulus wasn't big enough to put us in that type of accelerated job growth. The Fed is now moving in because, quite frankly, the Republicans are coming in and all, you know, they want to just gut regulations and cut taxes, which is what we had during the Bush years, and it didn't show an explosion in job growth then. And, you know, the White House is right to point out that this is the 10th straight month of some job growth and a total of more jobs created privately than through the 8 years of the Bush years.
Before we move off the news of the economy, let me just point out this, that the breakdown here is that private companies created about 159,000 jobs in October, while the government cut about 8,000 jobs. These are government jobs, state jobs that are cycling out perhaps because of budget cuts.
Tea Party people should love this news.
But the question I've got here for all of you is, what does this mean if we look at that private sector number? It's some, but clearly not enough. It exceeded expectations, but expectations were low. Byron?
I think it means that very, very little has changed. This is better, but it's only a tiny bit better. And the fact is that because demand is not where it needs to be right now, businesses are not adding jobs, they're not expanding, and we're stuck in this cycle at the moment.
And another thing I think it's important to remember is, quite frankly, right now the Fed is really the only – it looks like the Fed is going to be the only game in town to spark growth, because with the results of the election, Republicans coming in a majority in the House and, you know, having a larger group in the Senate, I think it's quite likely that we're going to see a lot of gridlock over the sort of normal tools of fiscal policy, things like, you know, doing more stimulus or tax changes. – So it's all going to be up to the Fed, and Obama's really going to be staking a lot of, you know, his hopes for a recovery by 2012 on the Fed.
Well, in fact, go ahead, David.
No, I was just saying the interesting thing about that is what the Fed is doing is probably going to generate some opposition from the right, from Republicans, not from Democrats. So there may be a battle between Bernanke and Boehner and Mitch McConnell and Michelle Bachmann. And at some point, they're going to have to explain why they're not just obstructing Obama on the stimulus end, why they're going to be obstructing Bernanke on the monetary end.
So President Obama made a statement, as we know, right after these numbers came out, saying that he's pleased with somewhat healthier job growth, but conceding that the economy isn't producing enough jobs to accommodate the people who need to work, to accommodate population growth, all of that kind of thing. He knows that. But then he went on to say that he, and I'm quoting here, he's open to any idea, any proposal that will jumpstart the economy. Is this the start of some kind of big reach?
No, he said that from the beginning. I mean, the Republicans, you know, if you read through their pretty thin, you know, manifestos pre and post election, you know, they basically are saying, let's just cut taxes and gut regulations, and that will stimulate the economy. Well, we've done that, and if they think, you know, what regulations do they want to gut? The ones for, say, underwater drilling? For mine safety? I mean, they can't really tell us what they want to gut and how that's going to create jobs. Maybe it'll create more oil cleanup jobs.
Byron, York.
Well, if the election was anything, it was a referendum on policies like the stimulus, where large majorities of American people feel that it did not work, or it did not work as well as advertised. Actually, I think it's probably beyond dispute that it did not work as well as advertised. And there is no political momentum for doing more of it. Republicans have suggested...
So what are these any ideas that he's open to? What are the
They're going to be the same old ideas. Republicans are going to suggest a significant payroll tax cut, or certainly extending the Bush, all of the Bush tax cuts and making them permanent. It is the same old argument. There's not some sort of new fantastic thing out there that would solve all of our problems that nobody will pass.
Well, the new fantastic thing out there, well, I don't know if it's fantastic, we'll see, will be the new Congress, will be the new political dynamic in this town.
Right, that's exactly right. And I think what you see, those kinds of statements coming from the White House, is what you see is the Obama administration trying to win back pieces of the coalition that put them in office in 2008. And statements sort of saying that they're open to any ideas, that's their effort to win back independent voters. You know, they won independents by 8 points in 2008. They lost them by 18 this cycle, so they're trying to do that. But they're going to be in a tough spot because they also have to sort of try to bring back you know, business allies who have split from the White House. We hear all the time at Bloomberg from CEOs who are really frustrated with the administration. And you saw in his press conference, you know, he commented that maybe those relationships hadn't, the president had said that maybe those relationships hadn't been managed as well as he ought to have managed them. And he also, at the same time, has to win back elements of his liberal base who are frustrated, feeling that his initiatives didn't go far enough. They want to see a public option in healthcare. So he's in a really tough spot, and there's no way he can make all these groups happy, especially given that Congress is going to be pretty much gridlocked.
Byron York, how do you read the lesson from this electoral torpedo?
Well, clearly, the one thing that happened was that I think the last couple of years of the Obama administration and 4 years of Democratic control in Congress made independents feel more conservative. If you look at the exit polls, more of them characterized themselves as conservative. Democrats stayed Democrats, Republicans stayed Republicans. Those independents really did switch over. I think the two important dynamics at work here are: one, the Republican candidates who won campaigned mostly in favor of repealing Obamacare and cutting federal spending. Those are the 1-2 punches all around the country. They really believe that, and they want to try to do that. Two, the president, not only in his news conference after the election, but in his upcoming 60 Minutes interview, seems to suggest that his biggest problem in the past couple of years is that he has not communicated his accomplishments effectively enough to the American people. That is a recipe for irreconcilable conflict, which is, I think, what we're going to have for the next 2 years.
That's what your
prediction
is. Well,
there'll be things that can be agreed on, and there'll be some smaller issues that are agreed on, but in terms of the big issues facing it, which is what you do about the economy, what you do about Obamacare, no, there's not going to be any agreement.
David Korn, gridlock squared?
Or tripled, or, you know, quadrupled. For the last 18 months, Barack Obama has faced an opposition that has used fear and demagoguery. They called healthcare death panels. That was an accurate and non-factual charge, and they repeated it again and again. Republican leaders, I think Eric Cantor and others said this, said that the stimulus created no new jobs. Not like not enough, but none. And again, they said things that were not so, and I think the White House completely dropped the ball in the debate for defining what was happening. They won these tremendous legislative victories, passing the stimulus bill, passing health care, passing Wall Street reform, you know, student loans, child health care, a lot of other things, by being very nuanced and putting their noses to the legislative grindstone. And the Republican view was, we're going to just block, say no, not participate, but we're going to get out there in the public square and say things that aren't true. We're going to hold rallies. Let me just one last point. They held a rally in November 2009 in which they had a crowd of Tea Partiers start chanting Nazis, Nazis, about the Democrats who were in favor of health care reform. I don't think you can deal with people like that, and I think the president missed an opportunity to show the public what was going on because he was too busy with the legislative details.
I mean, I think definitely we're in for a Congress of gridlock, even if you just look at the composition of who's come in. This election has left the House a much more polarized place. I think the Blue Dog Democrats.
People around the country are going to be hearing you and saying, more polarized than it's been?
I know, it's hard to imagine, right? But you look at the Blue Dog Democrats, which of course are fiscally, you know, conservative Democrats who, you know, tend to cross lines and work with Republicans. That caucus is half the size it was, you know, in October, just right before the elections. And you also, the class of Republicans who are coming in, a lot of them are affiliated with the Tea Party movement. They're new to politics. They have sort of they might have outsized expectations of what can get done. They're more ideological. It's going to be a tough place there.
We'll have more on the week that's just gone by and what it all means. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be back. And welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Our guest, David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief, Mother Jones Magazine, author of several books, most recently Hubris, Inside the Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War. He blogs at politicsdaily.com. Lisa Lehrer, she's politics reporter at Bloomberg News, and Byron York, he's chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. And we are talking, of course, about the week that was and is and will be going backwards and forwards, folks. And we already have a number of questions from our audience. Let me invite those of you who are listening, if you'd like to join us, at 1-800-433-8850 to do so. We'll get to you on the phones in a few minutes. Or you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Before we come back to this and some other themes, let me go to a couple of email questions we've already gotten because they're real good ones. Mike has written, could the panel talk about the Republicans' agenda, a lot of things they promised, such as repeal of the 14th and 17th Amendments, repealing of health care, balanced budget, holding the debt ceiling. Lisa, take a shot at that. What do you expect to actually come of some of those agenda items?
Well, one thing I know a lot of Republicans are talking about trying to do, at least, is repealing the health care law that was passed, of course, last session. I think that's going to be awfully hard, if not impossible, to do because Obama, of course, is not going to he's going to veto, I would imagine, the idea of repealing his own one of his own strongest legislative accomplishments. there's a question.
Has virtually, I mean, you know, he's right. He's going to.
He's not going to allow that.
Not, there's no vote to, not right. enough votes
the
to override
Democrats
and
still
in the Senate,
control the Senate.
Yeah, Democrats still control the Senate, so it's not going to happen.
But
and
maybe in the states, Byron? York?
I think, well, I think the thing to do if you're looking at Republican agenda in the House, where they do have control, they didn't run on repealing the 14th or the 17th or any other amendment. Look at the Pledge to America. This document that they rolled out a few weeks before the election talks about cutting government spending to pre-stimulus, pre-bailout levels, cap on discretionary spending, cap on cut Congress's budget, get rid of TARP once and for all, repeal Obamacare, medical liability reform, read the bill, advance word of legislative language, all of this stuff. Now, it may seem boilerplate to a lot of people, and it may have been criticized a lot when it came out, but they actually take this stuff seriously. So they are going to try to enact what they said they would do before they got elected.
Is there any chance that they or anyone else can move toward a balanced budget?
Well, if by moving toward a balanced budget, you mean reducing the deficit more?
Not from 1.4 to 1.2 trillion, but from 1.
Although that would be an improvement.
Well, of course it would, but you know, at the same time,
their number one agenda item, I think by far, is extending tax cuts on the wealthy, which will add close to $1 trillion to the deficit. So if they're talking about cutting $100 billion from, you know, discretionary spending, meaning, you know, environmental regulations, education, mine safety, and all that stuff, but yet they're adding $900 million in terms of, you know, tax cuts for the well-to-do, their deficit, you know, promises are not that serious. And if they want to go after, I mean, Dick Armey sent out a memo. You know, he's sort of one of the establishment Washingtonians who is trying to lead the Tea Party movement, saying that the first order of business really should be repealing health care in its entirety. Are they really going to go out there and say, we're going to allow companies to go back to pre-existing conditions? We're going to take kids who are on parents' plans up to the age of 26 now and rip them out of those plans?
Byron York, a quick response, and then I want to come over to Lisa.
Well, a couple of things. One, I would advise our listeners to go to something called Historical Tables of the U.S. Budget. It's published by the Office of Management and Budget. You'll see that between 2007 and 2010, federal spending went from $2.7 trillion to $3.7 trillion. Before, it went up about $120, $150 billion a year, but then it just wham, zoomed up there. So the idea of restoring spending to those levels is not at all unreasonable. And by the way, the federal budget deficit in 2007 was $160 billion. That's with Bush tax cuts.
Lisa Lehrer, let me ask you about the tax cuts to start with, okay? Because some of the first signals from the White House this last week after the election revolved around this tax cut package.
Right.
You're from Bloomberg News. You track these things closely. What are you seeing by way of signals? What do you read from them?
I mean, I think the White House has signaled that they could be happy with a one-year extension of upper incomes as long as the middle class tax cuts were made permanent. A lot of people think that this will get done during the lame duck session. Of course, all the rates go up on January 1st if nothing happens. I find that hard to imagine. I don't see the politics as such really coming together in a way that could actually get some kind of sustainable solution to the tax cuts.
So what happens with this matters because if nothing is done by the end of the year, everybody sees their tax rates go up to some extent. And if you're thinking about the impact on the economy, wow.
But it actually could be done in the next session, quick off the bat, made retroactive. It's better if they do it beforehand, but it's not, you know, the end of the game.
Is that what you expect?
They don't. You know, I think it's 50-50 whether they're going to work this out or not.
I think Republicans are going to get what they want on this because a number of Democrats had been caving before the election about making, if not making them permanent, extending all of them for, say, 3 years.
I think we heard this last week, too, the shot that will be heard round the next election then, because if on this tax hike issue, depending on how you see it, the solution is to kick the can down the road 2 years. Well, guess what 2 years from now is?
Right.
So aren't we already framing the next presidential election with this tax issue?
I don't know why Democrats didn't say they were going to prevent the Bush tax increases because that was built into the Bush tax cuts that they would indeed just last 10 years. But the fight is going to be over making them permanent. I think in terms of extending them for, say, 3 years, Republicans are just going to win on that.
There is an op-ed today in the Wall Street Journal written by John Boehner, under the headline, What the Next Speaker Must Do. The presumption is that's going to be him, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And here's among the things he says is, No earmarks. Let Americans read bills before they're brought to a vote. So all bills would be posted online for 3 days before there are any votes so people can read these bills. No more comprehensive bills, the sort of 1,000-page monstrosities in which all sorts of things can be buried that even the congressional members themselves may not know about. No more bills written behind closed doors in the speaker's office. Well, is this for real? True reform?
Well, first I say good luck and Godspeed. Getting rid of earmarks and some of these things that members like on both sides. But let's look at the last one there. No more bills written behind closed doors. Well, Republicans, and to some degree Democrats, but Republicans made, I think, more of a habit of this, of inviting lobbyists into the bill writing process. When Tom DeLay was running the House, he actually had a committee of top lobbyists who wrote and drafted legislation. And so if John Boehner, whose connections to corporate lobbyists have been well documented, is truly serious about ending secrecy in Capitol Hill, then I think he should just say which lobbyists he's meeting with, what are they suggesting, and ask the Democratic leadership and others to follow suit. I've asked him, and I think we at Mother Jones have asked him if he will do this, and he just won't even answer the question. So I think a lot of this is more is for show, and I don't think he's really serious.
Byron York?
First of all, on the three things that Boehner suggests, on earmarks, he is going to have trouble, probably not in the House, but with the Senate, where yesterday Mitch McConnell spoke to the Heritage Foundation, was very cool to the idea. Clearly not going to happen from his point of view. The Read the Bill, there's a bill actually requiring this, put bills up for 72 hours. I think that's very popular. It was co-sponsored by a Democrat as well. I think you're going to see that, whether they Democrats said they would do it, didn't do it, especially in the health care thing. It was the health care process, I think, was a travesty by a lot of people's estimation. As far as the comprehensive bills are concerned and who writes the bills, if you heard Republicans say anything in the campaign, it was that we've learned our lesson. We're going to do better. They contemplated, didn't have a lot of time to do it, but contemplated why they were so heavily defeated in 2006 and 2008. And this is one of the things that they vowed to change.
Lisa Lehrer.
But at the same time, I think future Speaker Boehner is going to find out that perhaps winning control of the House was a little bit easier than controlling his own caucus might be, because I think you have this group of Tea Party backed candidates coming in. A lot of them are new to Congress. A lot of them, you know, don't quite know how it works, and they have really, you know, big expectations about what they're going to get done. And at the same time, I would imagine he wants to at least be seen as, you know, getting things done on the economy, passing legislation through, you know, that could help Republicans.
So, Lisa,
in 2012.
What are you saying? How much did Tea Partiers help the Republican Party in this wave, and how much then are they, by
I think they definitely helped the Republican Party. I think they helped them win a lot of seats in the House. You know,
mobilized people.
Yeah, give enthusiasm, you know, make voters more energetic on their side, get people out to the polls. People have grumbled that, you know, it hurt the party in the Senate because, you know, some of the candidates that were put
Lindsey
up
Graham and others said some of these Tea Partiers, the Delaware race and others, cost them seats.
Right. People have made that case, but I would argue that it really helped them in the House. I mean, we did a quick analysis of the number of the 60 members that had been endorsed by Sarah Palin or by the Tea Party Express or Freedom Works, and it was at least half. So I think it really helped get a lot of these sort of new folks on the Republican side into the House. But now it's going to complicate things.
Let
There's
me go
no
for a sort of a lightning round of questions with you here, because we've got some
How many points?
How many seconds? We've got some great questions from the audience. I'd like to get them in. This one's from Melissa. Could your panelists talk about the implications for energy legislation and how Republicans might go after the EPA for its classification of carbon dioxide, what it means for the global warming, quote-unquote, Melissa says, debate? Lisa?
I mean, I don't see – I think the idea of curbing greenhouse gas emissions is over, and I think it's over for a long time. The Senate didn't want to do it. The issue became very, very toxic last year. Even sponsors of the legislation, the Senate said cap and trade. They didn't want to use that term anymore. It had been totally polluted. Forgive the pun, but
there've been a few of them here. So
right, I mean, I think the debate's going to be whether Democrats decide to do some things on energy that could be seen, you know, things that could get through, could be seen as throwing away carrots for getting, you know, getting limits on greenhouse gases later on. So I think that's going to be the debate, but I don't really anticipate seeing all that much on
all
that
right.
topic.
This one's for you, Byron. This one comes from Matthew. I'd like to hear what your panelists think about what the election really told Washington polls. I hear Matthew writes on NPR, told of a very mixed message. we don't like Democrats or Republicans. We like some of the health care bill, but not the process. What was the message, Matthew asks? It's the economy, stupid, or repeal the last 2 years?
I think that if you can say one thing about the public's attitudes about what's been happening in Washington is they felt that the Obama administration and the Democrats in Congress were doing too much, they were going too fast, and they were going too far on a number of things that Americans did care about, and that they were not paying enough attention to the economy during the year that they spent on health care. So I think it was simply a big message that said, you weren't listening to us. We told you what we wanted. You weren't listening, and this is what happens.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Going to move to your calls in just a minute. But before we do that, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine. David, Sarah Palin. Very visible role for her. She's leading in name recognition and maybe is the favored presidential candidate for the Republicans right now, though I don't know how much that really means. We're so far out. How do you assess how the role she played and how that has positioned her as a result?
I think in terms of TV ratings, she's doing very well. She's getting more attention. She gets it whenever she wants. I mean, if you had, you know, and I think she had a mixed night. I agree with Lisa. I think the whole Tea Party energy, you know, sometimes in a diffuse way, really helped the House Republican candidates. On the Senate side, it's a little more balanced. Easily the Republicans could have won Nevada and Delaware had the Tea Party candidate not won in the primary. That being Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Engel, and they won in the – and you can say the same thing in Alaska, too, with Joe Miller, and they all got tremendous boosts from Sarah Palin's endorsement. I think she still is the 800-pound grizzly in the room, and that no one can make a move presidentially without, you know, taking into factor whether she's going to run or not. I happen to think Michelle Bachmann's probably more interested in running for president than Sarah Palin, but there's no telling. And she is just going to continue. You know, what happened on Tuesday night preserves her position as the paramount Republican that we talk about.
Byron York, the Palin quotient?
Actually, I kind of agree with that. She had about a 60-40 night, which was good for her. But I think Republicans are pretty divided about her. If you ask them who they want to see run for president, she's not many of them's first choice. I remember speaking not too long ago to the head of the Palmetto Research Council, which is kind of the family research council for South Carolina, asking him about his members' feelings about Palin. He says, well, about half of them would not want to see her run. And the ones who do want to see her or wouldn't mind seeing her run don't all support her. So she remains a very divisive figure, even among Republicans.
Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg, before we go to the phones, let's connect the dots one more time on politics and the economy. How do you anticipate that this politics-economy equation is going to be affected by what the Fed has done with the $600 billion worth of quantitative easing, QE2, it's called printing money, it's called... What impact is that likely to have?
Well, you're certainly going to see a bit of an uproar on Capitol Hill amongst some of the folks who came in with Tea Party backing. The Tea Party movement is pretty concerned about the Fed and about their power. And I think, you know, there's sort of an alliance between more liberal members and more conservative members. You know, they want to audit the Fed. They want to open up the Fed. That was a problem during the renomination of Ben Bernanke. So I think you're going to see definitely some kind of outcry in Capitol Hill. And it could get a little tricky because, as I said before, that's really the only tool that's left in President Obama's arsenal at this point, given the gridlock everyone anticipates on Capitol Hill.
So we'll go to the phones. And Bob joins us from Miami, Florida. And Bob, thanks for being so patient and thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having this discussion. My comment was regarding the divisiveness that exists in our country today. On the one hand, I like to see that there is a Tea Party movement only because it energizes a little bit more politics in our country than we have had. We have tremendous apathy when it comes to politics. So it's nice to have some burr in the saddle getting people to think. But I think Mr. Obama is missing a tremendous opportunity to show real leadership. And that is that now the die is cast. He has 2 years to get some things done or continue to do his work. And I don't see him as a bridge. I really see him talking about politics as if it's a game, commenting on shellacking. This politics that we're dealing with right now is as serious as a heart attack. Everybody in the country is feeling it, and there are no easy solutions. And I think that I look to him for leadership. I don't look to him for politics.
Okay, thank you very much. A very thoughtful and important question. And David Corn, I wonder then, starting from Bob's premise that we have such a divisive environment, political environment, what is the role, what could the president be doing to bridge that?
You know, I think the president tried. I think he made one-third of the stimulus bill tax cuts as reaching out to the Republicans because that's their preferred
method. Well, that was then. This is now.
No, that was then. But what I'm saying is, you know, now didn't start on its own. I hear the music coming up, so we can pause for a second, I think.
Very good. You did my job for me. We're having the conversation, our news roundup. We'll talk more about politics, the economy, and take your calls for our panel after this very brief break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The EU and the U.S. step up efforts to improve air cargo security. Greece makes arrests in a series of parcel bomb threats, and Brazil elects its first woman president. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We've got our Friday News Roundup, and we're talking with David Corn, Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine, Lisa Lehrer, politics reporter at Bloomberg News, and Byron York. He's the Chief Political Correspondent for the Washington Examiner. And we're taking our listeners' calls and questions. Another question that's come in to us via our email, which is drshow@wamu.org. If you want to call us, it's 1-800-433-8850. Let me just rip through a couple of these, folks, and get a quick response to you before we go back to the phones. Here's one from Terry in Dayton, Ohio. The Republicans say they've heard the people's concerns, but one concern that's being ignored is that we, the people, are sick of the partisan bickering in Congress. Another person, your guest mentioned exploding deficits. When Obama came into office, he moved the budget for the wars to the public books. What's the impact of putting those into the budget? Another one, I watched my local electoral district carpet bombed with ads from groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with claims made by these ads dishonest and slanderous, says Gordon, who's writing from Rochester, New York. How can our democracy withstand this type of manipulation? Most people don't have any idea of the extent to which the wealthy are gaming the system. Finally, one more from David. Call me crazy, but I'm a middle-class taxpayer who'd like the government to cancel all the Bush tax cuts and use the money to pay down the debt. Byron.
Can I address one of these? This is a misleading talking point that you occasionally hear on the left, which is that Bush hid the cost of the war and he moved them off the books and Obama moved them on the books. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office or the Office of Management and Budget, for every year it has total receipts and outlays of the federal government. It always included the wars. Bush passed separate appropriations bills, which were debated publicly about the wars, but the cost of the wars has always been public knowledge.
Lisa?
Oh, I wanted to take the question about the money and the campaigns. The amount of money spent in this campaign, quite frankly, was mind-boggling. It was the most expensive congressional midterm election campaign in history. And I think even more than the amount of money coming in from 527s and all these groups, which of course have, you know, less disclosure rules than ever before, was the number of self-funders. I mean, I think one thing we took away from this election is that funding your own campaign is a really bad idea. There was about 60 of them that ran that put in more than $500,000. And of those, I think less than one in four actually won.
And Meg Whitman had real good return on investment,
right,
didn't she?
Meg Whitman, I think she spent, they worked it out, was over $140 million. And I think it ended up being $55 a vote. And she, I mean, just blowing through wads of cash. It's unbelievable to me.
But it turns out if you're a secret billionaire, things go pretty well for you in campaigns, because now you can put in as much money as you want into electing or diselecting people and not even have it be disclosed. I think this, you know, I think what we saw in this election with the dark money and the unlimited amounts of money was really just a warm-up. I don't think it's going to stop in the off year, 2011. I think these groups are going to keep trying to weaken and soften.
On all sides.
On all sides, but I think more so on the side that, you know, on the Republican side with Carove and Ed Gillespie already saying they're going to keep the ads going, even the lame duck session. And there is an advantage on the Republican side. It outspent the Democratic side by about $50 billion. And I also would argue that while you have unions doing the work, doing this sort of stuff in favor of Democrats, if you have groups that are funded by secretly, you know, a union is not funded secretly, but funded secretly by small numbers of individuals, millionaires, corporate titans with their own interests, that's a lot different than unions pouring money in something, which I think the union money is a problem. It's not the same type of problem.
Byron, since you wrote the vast left-wing conspiracy.
Well, the union money is being spent kind of coercively, in the sense that obviously not all union members would like to have their money spent in this way. And I believe the biggest single spender in this race was the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And the last thing is, I subscribe to George Will's point, which is the entire money spent in the entire politics this political season is less than Americans spend on potato chips a year. It's not something that bothers me.
May I just say, before we go back to the calls, and you can respond quickly to this if you'd like, that what strikes me from these comments is that what's come out of this election is hardly a rush of enthusiasm, idealism, and hope, which often attends our elections, less so in the off years, and certainly when the economy is down. But what really cuts through is this amplification of this notion that America's on the wrong track, that there's deep suspicion about anybody who spends money and anybody, virtually any politician, who makes any assertion about anything, and about the media. The role that the media are playing, this show accepted,
of course,
in this conversation. This is a disaffected, angry, alienated country, that should be concerning to everyone.
You left out one adjective: impatient. I mean, to recover 8 million jobs that were lost at the end of the Bush-Cheney years is going to take years, not 18 months. I mean, it may take a decade to bring back. And that's if you have the right policies and you do everything pretty smartly. But if you're sort of voting people in and out of office based on anger, you're not going to have any continuity and it's going to be counterproductive.
I've been actually calling this the Mel Gibson election. People are frustrated. People are angry. And they were showing that at the polls. And, you know, I think you saw that in some of the candidates. Some of the people that were put up for office weren't the most experienced or didn't have the longest resumes. And I think that's because people said, well, listen, we put in all these lawyers and longtime politicians and they haven't solved this problem. So why don't we try, you know, a guy who's a farmer and a gospel singer from Tennessee who took John Tanner's seat. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out once all these people actually come to Washington. Do they get co-opted, as Trent Lott has predicted, or do they, sort of stick to their principles? It'll be fascinating to watch.
To the phones, and Mike joins us now from Indianapolis. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Go ahead with your question. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm interested in thoughts around the unintended consequences of regulations that are written to implement laws, and I think a good example is the healthcare law. You know, there's this appeal, right to appeal, which will require that notices be sent out every time a claim is processed, even a pharmacy claim. If there's a copay or cost sharing of $10, someone has the right to go to an external panel and have that reviewed as to whether or not they should have to pay that $10 copay. And it's just bureaucratic and very costly, and I just will listen to your thoughts about that.
Thanks, Mike. Byron York?
Well, that is a huge point about the implementation of the health care bill. And I think since Republicans now control one house of Congress, it's very likely you're going to see Kathleen Sebelius testifying a lot before various committees of the House as they go into this. And this is one of the areas in which Republicans who probably will pass bills to repeal Obamacare, which will, of course, not get make it through the president's desk, this is one of the areas where you're going to see them cutting around the edges of the bill.
Next caller is George, who's phoning us from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, George.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I had former Democratic voter in Cleveland here. My main comment was, when Nancy Pelosi said we had to pass the bill to see what was in it, I just got fed up, and I thought it was emblematic of the way they were running things in Washington. And I guess until they get the message, I'm going to not be able to vote as a Democrat anymore, and I'd just like your panel to comment.
Okay, but before you go away, George, don't go away. So you say you're a former Democratic voter. Did you vote Democrat in 2008, and this is when you flipped, or had you flipped earlier?
No, I voted for Mr. Obama, and I thought he was really going to change things, and what he came out with wasn't what I thought was going to happen. And the way.
And what disturbed you most? What were you most disappointed by?
I think initially when he very first said that we're going to put the whole federal budget online and go through it line by line, and you're going to be able to see where it goes, and then they passed a stimulus package and a TARP package and all that, and you find out, you know, through news reporters where some of that money went. It was just disgusting, and people are still out of work. There's still no freight to haul in Cleveland, and the things they're doing aren't working.
Okay, George, thanks.
You know,
they're
supposed to be one of the ones, they're supposed to be the party, and I always thought they were, that made government work for the average guy, and when they got in, they haven't made government work, so why depend on the government?
George, thanks for your comment and your question about Nancy Pelosi and the health care bill. David Korn.
George represents the big problem that Barack Obama has. I mean, to begin with, the federal budget was online. Anyone could look. And in terms of the recovery package, all the money that was spent, I know this because I'm a reporter, I went through it, you know, was put online and people could look it up. Now, George, though, didn't feel the impact in a direct way, so to him it seems that nothing happened. You know, on the TARP bailout, which I was not a fan of at the time, and it's a big point for the Tea Party people, actually it was just reported, was it last week or the week before, that the U.S. government made a $25 billion profit on this, and they're going to probably get most of the money back, and it's not going to add to the federal deficit, and might, you know, even though implemented poorly and done not in the right, all the right ways, might have been a net gain. That's, you know, government making money is something the Tea Party people should like. So I think there are a lot of things get wrapped up all together, and Nancy Pelosi never said we have to pass the bill to see what was in it. Her point was that there's a lot of misinformation about this bill. This was her perspective. People, you know, hear a lot of different things about it. Once we pass it and they see it working and they see the benefits of it, then they'll come to appreciate what we've done. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, criticize George, but there's a lot of stuff flying around these days. And sometimes it's easy to get the wrong impression.
So George just doesn't know all of the really great things that the Democrats and the president have done for him.
Did you just listen to me, Byron? I mean, you can be snarky if you like. I just said that he didn't feel it directly because maybe in his situation. But every major economist, mainstream economist, says that the stimulus created or saved 2 to 3 million jobs.
But you don't. But here's the central problem that Barack Obama faces. It's not unlike, actually, the problem that George W. Bush faced with the issue of terrorism, right, in a sense. You don't get credit exactly. for what doesn't happen.
Exactly.
It's very, very difficult. Byron, your
report. this is the problem, I think, for Democrats and the president as they go forward. Because if you remember, just before the election, the president was at a fundraiser, I think it was in Massachusetts, and said that when people are scared, we're hardwired not to think clearly, suggesting that, you know, if the people were voting for Republicans, vote Democrats out of office, they would not be thinking clearly. So you have this twin idea of the electorate is not really thinking clearly, plus the president has failed to communicate his message, even though he gave, I guess, 50-plus speeches on health care. Democrats are not facing the basic unpopularity of a number of things that they have done.
This is a problem. This problem of the economy, the recovery not happening fast enough, is something the White House is going to be grappling with all the way to 2012. People talk a lot about, you know, what happened with President Clinton, President Reagan. They had losses in the midterms. They recovered. But what they forget is that Clinton saw unemployment was already declining by 1994.
Listen, folks, I'll date myself a little bit here. I was covering the White House and Ronald Reagan in 1982. I remember mm-hmm. being on the bus when we got the news that the unemployment rate had crossed 10%, double-digit unemployment for the first time since the Great Depression. I remember Reagan's numbers going down. They were actually lower than Obama's numbers right. now. I remember what happened in 1982 when the Republicans lost a couple of dozen seats plus in the House. And then what happened? Then the economy turned around and suddenly people were working again. We had a good Olympics in 1984. The country felt good, and it was morning in America, and 84 was a landslide. The question ultimately and always revolves around the lives that people are living outside of Washington on a right. day-in, day-out right. basis. Do they have jobs? Do they have hope? Do they have confidence?
And
do they feel optimistic?
Our predictions, at least at Bloomberg, for what the economy is going to look like in 2012 is not as rosy as it looked during Clinton or Reagan. We're, you know, our economists tell us 8.7 unemployment then, which isn't
8.7
in
2012,
which isn't something that's going to make people feel any less anxious about their personal situation.
It may not be morning in America. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. If you want to join our discussion here in the final minutes of the show, we're at 1-800-433-8850. You can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Donna from Indianapolis joins us. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead with your question.
Well, I'm curious. I'm not just curious. I'm a little frustrated with the media, and I wonder how you all plan to go forward, because it seems to me that through the years you're just being co-opted with your language. Obamacare, 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 death panels, death tax. You know, my mother died, my father died. There was no tax. That's an estate tax. And I really wonder what the media plans to do about language in the future.
Donna, thanks very much for your question. Who wants to start? Donna's got lots of company, by the way, not being real thrilled with the media these days.
I'm sure. It's a very important question, because how you define the terms of a debate often determines who comes out ahead, you know, in politics, not always in policy. And, you know, the media often has trouble because each side tries to lobby for its terminology, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice is a good example. And the media often has trouble trying to figure out how to call these things for what they are or be fair and square about it. But ultimately, I do think it comes down to the participants in the policy debates. You know, each side gets its best shot and has to make the best pitch it can. And if, Sarah Palin wants to get out there and call something a death panel when there is not a death panel, well, then I do think in those instances, the media has an obligation to sort of take a good look at it and say, listen, she's just not right.
Part of the problem, it seems to me, though, is not just the language that is used and is chosen. And as David says, it's often the politicians who try to frame the issues with the language they choose, and then the media follow or don't, as the case may be. But the media, especially some of the cable and online media components, have leapt on the conflict because conflict sells. And what's unsettling to people is this becomes sort of a reinforcing cycle. And people are pointing to the media saying, what's your responsibility in breaking this cycle? What are you going to do about it? Any response to that?
Well, two things. People are talking, perhaps they're exaggerating a conflict that does exist. We have a lot of problems. The economy is terrible. We know all this. And there are fundamental differences between the parties over how to handle it. And we just had an election, and, you know, the Republicans won this one. Clearly, Democrats won the last two in a very, very big way. These are fundamental differences between the parties. And let me say one thing about unemployment, which is voters did not miraculously expect unemployment to go way down this time or even for the next election. They were voting on whether they thought things were on the right track, of whether what the present Democrats were doing would lead us to a better situation. And they concluded that they weren't. So they do not expect miracles, but they do expect the government to be doing what they view as the right thing.
Lisa Lehrer, I'm going to pull the rug out from under you here. And with the 1 minute or so remaining, there was one other topic we wanted to get to, and we're not going to give it sufficient time, but I do want to touch upon it, and that's George W. Bush's new memoir that's just out. In it, he says that he approved of some of the waterboarding against a colleague, Sheikh Mohammed. He says that he defended the decision to go into Iraq, saying that the Iraqi people are better off with a government that answers to them instead of torturing and murdering them. What's the impact likely to be of George W. Bush's take on his own legacy?
Well, one thing I really enjoyed reading about was how he said that Kanye West's comments that he doesn't care about black people was something that really hurt him, and he really felt that. And I always find it fascinating when we get these sort of glimpses of humanity into these our presidents and our leaders. So I found that a really interesting sort of side part of that, what's come out about that book.
Very quickly.
He said that he thought he had given diplomacy a chance to work in Iraq. That wasn't true. The inspectors were there. Things were going forward. He cut that process short. He wanted the war.
David Korn, Byron York, Lisa Lehrer, thanks so much for the look back and look ahead. Appreciate it. Have a good day. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show.